Level Up can now be found online at lulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at lulpodcast. And you can now subscribe to us on iTunes and Google Play under Level Up Language. Level Up is brought to you in part by Davis School District and Clearfield High School. We hope you enjoy, and thanks for listening. Today's episode is about split-level classes, what they are, and a strategic approach to teaching those classes in the world language setting. Think about your most diverse class, whether it be split by levels or ability, as we get in to Level Up. Welcome back to Level Up. I'm excited to be your host today. This is Miles Nance. I'm joined by Brandon Welker, and we're only two today. Our other hosts, Roger Burt and Davin Lemke, are off in Nashville, Tennessee at the ACTFL conference for 2017. We're excited for them to be there. So we know some of you are there. Hopefully you're enjoying yourself and learning some things that you can take back to your classroom. We'll hear in a couple of weeks from Roger and Davin on some of the things that they've been learning. One of the things they went there for specifically is IPAs, which we're starting to use in our district to test at mid-year and end of year. So we're really excited about what they're able to bring back for us. But as I mentioned earlier at the onset of the episode, this episode is about split level classes. First, really quickly, what a split level class is. I mean, there's a lot of different varieties of split level classes. It can be split based on ability or split on actual levels. For example, in our district, the split level classes probably are mostly going to be higher levels for French, German, Chinese. There may be some occasional higher levels for Spanish, but usually Spanish is a lot more, there are a lot more students that enroll in our district in Spanish. Whereas German and French and Chinese at the higher levels, they don't generally have as many students enrolling. So what'll happen, at least here at Clearfield, we need to have at least 15 to 20 students to sign up for a class to make it a specific class. And again, those level, for me, level 3 and 4, I don't get as many. So what they'll do is they'll combine those into one class. And sometimes even that will be combined with others. And I'll kind of get into that a little bit later in the episode. But that's a split level class where the students, not just different ability, but they're actually in two different classes at the same time. It's the same class period, but two different classes. And it's a perfect episode for Roger and Davin to be gone because they don't generally have these classes. But Welker and I, Brandon Welker and I both do. So we're excited to talk to you about what we try to accomplish in our classrooms, how we try to organize them to make them easier for ourselves and hopefully easier for the students. So we'll talk about some of our strategies. But first, we're going to be joined by two other faculty members here at Clearfield High School. We did a brief interview with them to try to get some insight. And they're non-world language teachers, but everybody, regardless of whether they teach world language or they teach health or they teach whatever they teach, they're going to deal with classes that are split on ability, if not the actual class itself. So let's dive right in and give a listen to their interviews. We're joined today by two fantastic teachers at Clearfield High School, Jake Vockler and Celia Larson. So I'm going to have them do a quick introduction of who they are.
I'm Jake Vockler. I am a special education teacher here at Clearfield High School. This is my second year here. Currently, I teach resource language arts for the 10th graders, and I teach resource U.S. history for 11th graders, and I also teach a unit of general education U.S. history. I've coached football here for the last 2 years, and that's about it for me.
And you're the sole reason we've increased our win percentage. Is that just you? Can we put it all on your shoulders?
Don't tell anybody else, but yes, that's true. It's 100% me. No, not at all. I feel like I've made an impact. I do feel like I made an impact. I work really well with kids, which is, you know, why I'm a teacher. We've made a lot of progress and I'm pretty dang proud of it.
Yeah, it's great.
So I have been teaching at Clearfield for about 9 years, and I teach AP U.S. history for 11th graders, and I teach regular U.S. history. I've taught almost all the social studies here, or all the regulars. So I taught regular World Civ, and I've taught government as well. I was in charge of student government for 5 years, and I loved it. It was a lot of fun, but we have turned the reins over Brandon. He just looked too sweet. He looked too nice, and we needed to harden him. So we gave him a really hard job.
It's working.
Good.
He had too much free time on his hands. We needed to get rid of that.
He kept telling me how he was going out on Friday nights, and I was like, I'm going to need that to stop.
That needs to be over with.
But I love teaching here. I also teach Fly Team, where we go down and the high school kids go down and do like anti-bullying skits and such down for our feeder elementary schools. So it's fun to see the future Falcons and get them excited to come here. The football record is helping. It's giving us some street cred.
It does. So. It does help.
I hear lots of good things about the Fly Team though. They're doing fantastic
work. They're super great and they love it and the kids love seeing them and it's a lot of fun.
Do you do IB as well?
Yeah.
Celia? Okay.
I do IB as well.
So you do IB history?
IB Americas.
So, IB Americas? So, North and South?
No. Well, we...
Does Canada included?
So the IB, the way IB Americas is split is we're supposed to cover Mexico, but because we have them take the AP test, we don't have time. So sometimes we cover Mexico after, but usually it's picked up in 20th century. They just cover Mexico right at the beginning.
Yeah, okay.
Because they get to pick what they test on. So we just make sure they pick the U.S. information.
Fantastic. So. Well, thanks for those introductions. We've kind of brought you here for a reason. We singled you two out. One, because we knew, Celia, you've been here for a while, and Jake, you're relatively new, second year. But also, not just because of that, but your classes that you teach. And when we're talking about split-level classes, Celia, for example, we know that you teach a couple of classes during the same class period, so we thought you'd be perfect. And then Jake, where you teach special education classes, you're going to have a varying degree of levels in those classes. So we tried to single out a few people that we thought would be great for this. And also, we always hear great things from the students about you. So
that's what I was going to say, the kids love both of you guys.
Yeah.
Well, we hear a lot of
news to me.
So we want to know.
It's usually in my fan mail. So
we basically want to know what you're doing. So, and that's kind of leading into that. So, really quickly, Celia, what classes do you have that are actually mixed together in the same period?
So my first and third period class are listed as AP US History and then IB Americas.
Okay.
And so it's probably about a 60-40 split. Most of the kids that I get are AP kids just because IB isn't as big, but they sit intermixed. There's no segregation in the room. They all sit amongst each other. So but in my regular ed class, I do actually have quite a few kids with IEPs.
Right.
That aren't in like full special ed, but need those same types of accommodations.
Right.
With kids who could be an AP and are just not.
What kind of strategies have you used in your classes in general and specifically in your AP IB class to try to reach everybody?
So I think the biggest thing is language. We do a lot of professional development talking about how each test refers to certain skills. So the IB test might call their writing portion a certain name and the AP test will call it something different. So we just make sure that we use both types of language and we let the kids know what they're looking for. It's actually been really nice because in the last 2 years, they've revamped the AP test and it aligns more with the IB test. The same type of language is being used. So they're getting asked the same types of questions. We can ask one question, but use two different rubrics. We can use the IB rubric for the IB kids and the AP rubric for the AP kids.
Would you say the curriculum is much different between the two?
The IB curriculum has a lot more fluidity within it. It allows for the teacher and the students to kind of pick what parts they want. I think there's like 25 questions on their written portion and they only pick three.
Right.
So we just make sure that we cover the three that are on the U.S. history test.
Okay.
That would be covered under U.S. history. So we make sure we hit the civil rights movement. We make sure we hit the 1920s and the Great Depression and the Civil War. And those are the questions the kids will usually write on because we know what the questions are ahead of time. Whereas with the AP kids, we don't know what the questions are ahead of time. So we just cover it all. But we tell the IB kids when we get to that time in history, we say, this is going to be on your IB test. And this is the type of question that you're going to get asked. So make sure you understand the information.
Okay. And Jake, you teach resource, special education.
Same thing. Yeah,
potato, potato.
Pretty much.
The classes don't have different labels, right? So they're all the same. This first period is this, but you've got a wide variety of students. Talk to us about some of those. If you can give examples, how diverse some of the students are.
Yeah, it's funny because listening to the examples that are given for the AP IB, I feel like I'm on the total opposite end of the spectrum as far as student ability, academic ability and whatnot. But we're probably gonna have a lot of similar strategies, which is pretty cool. But so essentially what will happen is I have 3 periods every day that are English class. It's a language arts class for 10th graders. But it's a resource level class. And what that means is all of my students are on an IEP. And that means that they all have some sort of individualized goal or, you know, it's individualized education plan. And so they each have their own goal that they're working on, when it comes to reading or writing or both. And so I can have in one class and do have in one class somebody who reads at a 10th or 11th grade level, but can't write 2 sentences if I paid them $100 to do it. And then sitting next to that student, I have somebody who reads at a first grade reading level, and we're supposed to cover Life of Pi in that class. And how do you do that when Life of Pi is written at a 10th grade level? Mm-hmm. And I've got somebody who could probably still be reading picture books. And so it becomes very difficult.
So in that particular instance, what are some of the strategies that you've used to try to help out?
So the main strategy I use, when it comes to that big of a difference, and that big of a difference is a pretty extreme example. I will have anywhere from 10 to 1 and everywhere in between. So what I typically will do in that specific example is I'll find early on, in the term or the year actually, is I will figure out where their reading levels are. I run a couple of different assessments on them, figure out where they're at reading level wise. And then when we get into our reading, as a class, I'll actually group them up into groups of 3, where I'll find somebody who's kind of on the higher level, somebody who's on a middle level, and somebody who's maybe a little bit on the lower level. And then when we will read, say 2 chapters that day, I'll say, okay, go into your teams and read the next 2 chapters. Here are your questions that we're going to talk about after. These are your definitions for the, you know, vocabulary for this time. And what I found with that is I get a lot of success because the kid who's kind of a higher end reader actually can help coach and teach the mid and lower level readers. And as we all know, as teachers, the best way to learn is to teach something. And so it's really cool because they're able to, some of the words that maybe they're a little bit better at, right, that middle or low level student aren't very great at. And so they can help fill in and make sure that they correct them and whatnot while they're reading. But that lower level and that mid level get that correction from a peer, and it's not always from me. So if it's always from the teacher, sometimes they shut down because they've been corrected so many times by a teacher that when it's by a peer, sometimes it can be more of a positive. So I've had a lot of success with that. And it really helps also that middle level too, because sometimes that middle level can help that lower, and that lower is getting direct instruction from 2 more advanced readers. And so it's really good.
What he's describing, we just did in our AP classes, Mrs. Wimmer and I, we were looking at our kids' test scores, and we were realizing that there was like clusters of higher test scores and clusters of lower test scores. And sometimes, you know, I know I've done in the past, like you rest on the laurel of the idea that they're all AP, so they must all be smart, you know, yeah, or they all can do it. But we were realizing that we weren't tiering them correctly, and we weren't giving them the opportunity to have that peer-to-peer support. And so just in the last 2 weeks since the quarter began, we created our tables based on their last 2 test scores. So we have a high, an upper middle, a lower middle, and a low on the same table. And just the discussions alone, the authenticity and the academicness of it. I don't think academicness is a word, but it is now.
You've just smithed it.
You just made it.
But yeah, has really brought it up, because what we had before was where you had kind of a cluster of lower kids. They were either not talking about what we were supposed to be talking about, or they weren't saying anything because there was no one to guide them on where to go. And then you had, you know, the upper kids that are having these super deep conversations, but not sharing that with anybody.
Yeah.
So it was actually because we were talking to another teacher that they had brought up this idea of tiering them within the class. And it has changed our ability to get feedback faster of what they're able to do and to help them get that reiteration, mm-hmm, without it just coming from me. Mm-hmm. So that's been great.
That's fantastic.
Smart.
Kind of a follow-up there. Do the students know that's what you're doing?
My kids don't.
They know, I'm in the dumb group, I'm in the smart group.
They're at tables, and I didn't tell them, like, they don't know each other's test scores.
Right, okay.
And for my kids, and I think, I would assume maybe on your, because they're all in the same type of class, right? They're all in AP, so they all think they're great. right? Or they're all in resource. So they all know that they're all struggling with something.
Yep, correct.
So it's a, for me to be able to tier them, they don't recognize that the other one is lower because they're really probably not that much lower. They're lower than they are. And what I'm also realizing is my high kids might be really good at multiple choice testing, but it's my lower kids on multiple choice that are better at writing. So it's almost like the table flops when we're doing a different topic. But I'm realizing that by happenstance, the kid who is lower on our multiple choice is doing better on the writing because their brain thinks about it in a different way. And so they're able to model that portion of it for the rest of the table. So they're both sides are feeling successful and no one's feeling like they're constantly being talked down to by somebody smarter than them.
Just a side note, tables are kind of nice. This is my first year with tables.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a little team and you can do stuff with the team, right?
Yeah.
Not every classroom has
but
that,
even but if you had a nice. Four, even if you had desks, I've done it in classes, in my regular classes before. And, I just numbered my desks 1 to 4 and they were color coordinated because I'm a girl and I like that kind of stuff. So it was like all the blue or, you know, all the blues got together and it was 1 to 4 uh-huh. and then they were tiered that way as well. So anytime we needed to do group work, they knew how to, without always being in a group, they knew who to group with.
I'm not that organized and I'm not that thoughtful when it comes to my, or my organization of my teams. But to answer your original question on do they know, or is it, it's to me, last year, I didn't say anything about it. I just said, this is your team. Go to town. And this year, as a second time through, almost as an experiment to see, I did some coaching on it and I didn't say like, hey, Johnny's the low reader and Mark, you're the high reader. But I said, in your group, you're going to find that somebody is a better reader than you, or you're going to find that somebody struggles more than you. Here's why. And I kind of gave them a reasoning. And then I coached them up on, if you are the person who you sense that you're the person who's a little bit more above the other, then there's a reason for it. And here it is, right? And I told them, you're the one who I'm relying on to give that person some help, right? And if you're the person that is the one getting some help, this is why, right? And so I gave them the reasoning. My purpose behind that is hopefully getting them thinking about their learning and like almost a metacognitive kind of a process, right? Them thinking about that. I have a clue whether that's going to turn into anything by the end of the year, but how else would I know unless I give it a shot?
So far it's been.
So far so good. So far I haven't had a problem. I feel so far I've had a good response because as I've walked around, I see that person who is the higher reader almost taking like a pride is a bad word, but a pride in the fact of like, they're more willing to jump in because they know that they're the coach, mm-hmm. right? And I feel like it's been good so far. We'll see long term how that goes.
And just a thought, maybe in a way it teaches them, you know, there's always going to be people that are better at a skill than you may be.
Absolutely.
And how to take instruction.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then also if you're maybe better at something than somebody else, how to give that sort of instruction.
Absolutely.
And not be.
Yeah. It's kind of nice because the alternative is, especially at a resource level, the alternative is I can sit up in front of class and read the whole stinking book to them. And I don't want to do that 3 times a day, reading the same 2 or 3 chapters every day. There's a lot of research that goes behind that does help struggling readers, but I don't want to do that every day. And I want them to take some ownership of it. And mm-hmm. just like you said, because there's some purpose behind that. So
you've both given some fantastic ideas as far as, what's worked. It seems like the grouping strategy has been a great strategy so far.
Yes.
I've tried that here or there. I probably need to do a better job at that. But let's jump into the not so goods. What's something maybe you've given a shot at during the lesson, or maybe a day later you just realize it just fell on its face?
I don't know. I'm really
if you don't
good
mind sharing.
At what I do. So, and in all my 9 years of experience.
And very humble about it,
right,
as well, you can
right,
see.
Right. Actually, sometimes what flops is when you think you've given them the opportunity to learn a skill more than once, and you realize in the end they still don't know how to do the skill. I struggle a lot with vocabulary because I try to give them an opportunity to like learn what the word means and then use the word in a sentence and then put it into context. That's a big part of our historical skills, are putting everything into context. And then when an assessment comes or we do a short answer and it's the same for us, it's usually an event or a person or a piece of legislation. Then it comes and they still don't know what it is. And I am always like, I don't understand how else to teach this to you. You know, I feel like I've done it on all the levels I know how to do it. But what I realized and what I'm getting from Jacob is that I don't give them the opportunity to take ownership of the knowledge and to give them an opportunity to use the knowledge in a setting where they can both do the teaching and be taught. And so that's something that we're really trying to emphasize in our AP classes is to allow them to have more conversations amongst themselves instead of me guiding the information or guiding the conversations. And it's hard in an AP class because I have so much to cover in such a short amount of time and I have to hit that deadline because they're going to be tested on it and they're paying a lot of money for it and they're trying to get their college credit and, you know, all those things that come along with standardized testing. But we're realizing that it would be better for them to be authentic in their knowledge of a less amount than it is for them to be inauthentic of their knowledge of the whole amount, because that inauthenticity isn't giving them a higher test score. And that's what we're looking at. We're looking to see, okay, what's our final pass rate?
Yeah.
And when we look at schools like Davis High that have a 95% pass rate, you know, they're, because their clientele is different and their home lives are different, they can put a lot of emphasis of that authenticity on the home portion of it. Whereas we need to do a lot of that here in the building because this is where they do a majority of their learning. And our kids can accomplish the same. They can accomplish anything here. I'm not saying that they can't. I'm just saying that as an educator, I have to be more cognizant of giving them opportunities to have those conversations, those intellectual conversations in the building, because chances are they aren't going to have that opportunity at home.
Right. Too
because
busy
they're
working
or their parents are working or, you know, there's so many things that get in the way. And so by doing that, we've allowed them to take more ownership. And I think that's what I take from Jacob's comment is that his kids feel ownership over the things they know and ownership of the things that they don't know, which is important because recognizing what I don't know helps me understand what weaknesses I need to work on. And if I never have the opportunity to not know something, then I don't know what I need to work on.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's why I was going to say what Jake said was really good was when you group them and you're kind of open about the fact that there may be some better readers here than you. And if you recognize that you are or aren't the best reader in this group, there's something to learn from it. And there's a reason for that. I'm of the opinion that we do that exact thing, that we're open with them, that we build this culture of we all have strengths and weaknesses and let's be honest about them and see what we can do to get better at it. So I like the idea a lot of creating that culture of, you know, you don't point out and say, hey, Johnny's a terrible reader. Look at him. But we talk to the kids individually and we say, hey, you did great on this. And here's where we can work a little bit.
Many of the classrooms that I go into here is that it's a safe place for people to fail.
Yes.
And sometimes I am cognizant that when I fail in front of the kids, that I point out that it's okay that I'm a horrible board speller. Like I suck at spelling on the board.
Join
I always spell something wrong and I can't draw worth a hill. So draw map of the United States, Florida is bigger than Texas every time. But I feel like that creates a space where kids can be on a mixed level and that they can feel it's okay to say something that isn't correct.
Yeah.
I don't like dumb comments, but I am okay with when you say something and you think it's right and it's wrong.
Right.
Give it a shot.
Give it a shot. Yeah. And always to try. And that when we try and we fail, our responsibility as educators is to just help you try again. I don't have to take away the failure. I just need to give you the opportunity.
And you say you haven't listened to any episodes. Yeah, I've been trying to trademark a phrase, although somebody's probably already come up with it. We've been saying a lot over the last few episodes that it's okay to fail. Just fail better next time.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that we say all the time in my classes is that it's okay to not know. It's not okay to not try. And it's like a mantra that we say as a whole anymore at this point, where I can say the beginning part of it and they'll finish it, for that exact reason. And another thing that we say on the football field all the time as coaches is that kids can smell bullcrap from a mile away. And if you're going to act like you're the one that knows it all and you're the sage and you're the this, you're the that, the reality is you don't know as much as even you probably think you do sometimes.
That'll blow up in your face.
Yeah. When you're very open and honest and almost blunt to a certain degree and saying, hey, this is why we're doing this. And because I know it's going to help you guys. And when I make a mistake, I absolutely point it out. And when you make a mistake, we're going to work on it and that's okay. Yeah. Right. And this is all like perfect, phenomenal classroom. And it's not always that amazing, but it can happen anyway.
I want to thank both of you for coming on, both, Jake Vaukler and Mrs. Larson.
It's
Celia Larson.
It's Celia.
Celia.
That's how I introduce myself.
We do appreciate you coming on and the insight you have. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
You
guys are awesome.
Need any more help, thanks. Let me know.
I just want to thank Jake Vaukler and Celia Larson for taking that opportunity or taking the time really to be on that and give us some good insight. And I wrote down a couple of notes during the interview. And one of the things that Jake had talked about that he did that first is, with his reading groups is the first thing you want to do is determine the level of the student. Now we've started to do an IPA here in the district where at the end of the year, middle of the year and the end of year, we get that so the other teachers can see, let's say there's someone coming from a junior high to a high school, you can see more or less the level of the student. So you have a pretty good idea. Obviously they forget stuff over the summer, but that's a good introduction to kind of see what, even though you've got a level two class, for example, you can see where the students are needing help and where you can work on that. So as he was talking about grouping, and this is something I mentioned during the interview, whether it was on air or off air, I don't remember, but I mentioned that I struggle at grouping students appropriately, and that's something I need to do better at. Knowing what their level is and being able to group them where the higher or the students that are a little bit better at, let's say, speaking, are with students that don't fully struggle but need a little bit more help and pushing to that they can do it. They just need that extra little nudge to get there. So I need to do a better job myself. And where we teach four different modalities of communication, speaking, reading, writing, and listening, the students are going to kind of be all over the place. You may have a student that's fantastic at writing that doesn't speak very well or doesn't listen and comprehend very well. So we've got four modalities, really, we've got to measure them on and depending on the purpose of the activity, group them differently, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You got kids that love talking but hate writing things down. You have to go bug them about writing stuff down. And you got kids that will write you pages, but then you try to get them to talk to you.
It's almost like the grouping strategy. You would potentially have to have a group for each of the modalities. What were some of the things that you noted? I mean, that was the big thing for me. Celia had some good ones. She was talking about flopping, where you feel like you've, and this really hit home for me, and I think will hit home for a lot of world language teachers, is feeling like they've had enough time with the vocabulary. They should know it. When I've found that's not, there's never enough time. There's never enough.
That's so true. Just going back to having Celia and Jacob as the guests, it was more genius than we realized. Maybe they are non-world language teachers, but you know, Celia was talking about AP and IB learners, which are generally advanced learners or maybe just, you know, kids driven to get a lot of college credit and think at a higher level, things like that. And Jacob deals with students that struggle with some of those things and may lack some motivation because they haven't felt successful with that. So he's got a big job there. But so we've kind of heard from both ends of that spectrum. And in foreign language, we've got kids, you know, at every ability level. So just differentiation in general is the name of the game of modern teaching. And we're trying to find different ways to do that. And Jake actually mentioned off mic that he had, we didn't have him share this experience, but that he flopped with us with the flipped classroom strategy. He flopped with that and he didn't tell us the details, but I just know that there are a lot of strategies nowadays that are in general designed to differentiate and kind of reach every kid in your class. And the flipped classroom is where you have them watch videos of pre-recorded lectures and ideas and lessons at home. And then in class, you do the discussing and the polishing and correcting and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, I think we've all been through things like that where things have flopped. And I really liked what Celia was saying about being open about your imperfections and being clear with the kids that, you know, you're not the best whiteboard drawer or anything like that, creating that kind of a culture. I really liked what they said. And both of them kind of talked about it. It's just what I liked about them saying that is in all of our classes, we have to build some kind of foundation that we can build everything else off of. And I think part of that foundation to be able to approach different levels more easily is a foundation in part where you have the culture that being wrong is okay and trying it is okay and that there's no fear in making an effort, even if you're going to be wrong, because we can just correct it and try it again. I think that having that culture, being able to show the kids that it's not a problem to make an effort, even if you're going to be wrong, because you can correct it and do better next time, And those experiences are the best way to learn. Having that kind of a culture is an essential part of your foundation in a classroom where you have to teach multiple levels. And just differentiating in general is necessary because kids come from all kinds of backgrounds. You really have 30 kids in a class, you're going to have 30 different levels that you're teaching at in reality. But we're going to get into talking a little bit more about actual levels. They have different classes within one period, and that's what we're going to talk about now.
Just getting into my story, when I was first hired, you know, the whole whirlwind, it's my first teaching job, whirlwind of, yeah, you got the job and here's all the stuff you're doing. Oh yeah, great. Yep. Oh, any questions? I don't know. Probably eventually. And it didn't really hit me until round about August started that I would be teaching, or I would have a class that was composed of level 3 French, level 4 French, the second year of ab initio, IB ab initio. So the testing year basically. And yeah, so three different classes, three different levels in one class period. And I started to go crazy looking at all the IB requirements, looking at all the district requirements that we have here in Davis School District for levels 3 and level 4. And not knowing how, you know, differentiating is key, and everyone should have some kind of strategy to help with differentiation. But when you have three different actual classes in one class period, it just struck me as what the heck am I going to do? What am I going to do for, do I really go off of three different curriculums? Right. And I started asking around, what do other people do? Roger was a big help to me, and I eventually came to the consensus, and it's kind of been building over the last few years because I've been doing it the same way. This year I've got levels 3, 4, second year IB, and an AP student. My first AP student. I've got you all in one class, them all in one class, and I've been doing the same thing where, according to our district's expectations, levels 3, 4, IB the second year for ab initio, I've pegged them all at, and we at the district have pegged them at, being in the intermediate level. Now, like level 3 is just barely there, intermediate low at the first part of the year to intermediate mid at the end of the year. IB ab initio students, I try to get them into that intermediate mid range. As I feel like based on the tests that I've had so far, that's where they need to be to pass. And then level 4s, they need to be in the mid-range of intermediate, and AP, that's kind of the cusp of where they need to be to start passing, intermediate mid to a high. But they're all intermediate students. And I thought, rather than breaking racking my brain to do different lessons for all 3, 4 classes in some cases, I'm just going to teach the same lesson. And what I've been doing the last few years is alternating between level 3 and level 4 curriculum. I've tried to put special emphasis, and we have as the district creating the curriculum, in making sure that levels 3 and 4, every unit has an AP theme associated with it, and every unit has an IB theme associated with it. So yes, I'm still covering AP information, and yes, I'm still covering IB information, but I'm doing it all in the confines of the same unit, so I don't have to think about and plan about all sorts of different levels that way, a different curriculum that way. And I can focus really on the differences between the students, differences between a 3 and a 4, intermediate low and intermediate mid. They're both at the intermediate level. There's just some slight differences. And what's helped me with that is making sure the students are aware. I read through the actual descriptions for intermediate low and mid, and I read those to them to try to help them understand where they should be. And I'll tell my level 3 students, all right, on this test that you have, it's written, and this is where you should be. This is where you're expected to be. If you want to get an A, you've got to do a little bit more. And same for level 4. These are your expectations. So I make sure the students know, but I think it's worked out for me. It's been a lot easier for me in that, again, they're all intermediate students, and just treating it as an intermediate student. And that's just helped. Some are just farther along at the intermediate level is all. And that's really helped me keep my sanity. Now, I know, Welker, you've got some mixes as well. This year's are pretty good. It's a little bit more broad, it's a little bit more wide this year. Is that normal?
I was actually going to say, you mentioned this in the intro before the interview, that Roger and Davin are gone, and they both teach Spanish, and you and I teach French and German, which aren't as populated as Spanish. So this happens to us, and so when the cats are away, the mice can play a little bit and talk about German and French specifically, and probably Chinese. I would imagine this happens, like you say, Can I just read to you what I have in my sixth and eighth periods? These are my mixed ones.
Yes.
In sixth period, I have level 2, level 4, and then I have IB ab initio second year and IBSL second year. And then I also have concurrent enrollment at Weber State 1010, which correlates with level 2. But on Canvas, it's a pain, by the way, because they all have separate classes and you have to go like put it all in there. But anyway, so that's one class. And then eighth period is similar. I have levels 3 and 4, and then I have first year SL IB and then concurrent enrollment 1020 and 2010, which also correlates with 3 and 4. So that is terrifying when you first look at it. And just like you were saying, Miles, it's a little bit paralyzing, at least for me at first, especially when I first got here too, because I taught math before this, which is for the most part, you know, one level at a time. And so when we started, when I got here and realized that we had IB and the regular levels, we didn't even have CE yet at that time, I didn't know what to do. And actually, I felt pretty paralyzed in my mind. And Kelsey Flint, who was one of our distinguished guests last week, I just caught her in the office one time and I was telling her that I had IB kids in there and she had taught Chinese and was still teaching Chinese at the time. And she said, well, I just teach everybody to the level of IB. And as simple as that sounds, it just was kind of a revelation like, yeah, okay, we're all learning German here. There's no, you know, I don't have kids learning Spanish over here and German over here or whatever. So I don't know that this would work as well in a math class because you've got kids learning statistics over here and calculus over here and trigonometry over here. But in language, we're all really building towards the same thing, like you said, for the most part, intermediate level speakers in high school. And then I kind of thought to myself, well, yeah, it's kind of like in a weightlifting class, a gym class where you're lifting weights. You can have kids at all kinds of levels in there. You're all really doing the same thing. You're just going to have Matthew over here, for example, who's new to weightlifting, start with smaller weights. He's still doing the bench press. He's still doing the deadlift and the arm curls and all those things, but he's not lifting as much weight and we don't expect him to because he's new there. So we treat him as all one big group that's heading to the same destination, but we expect a little bit different things out of him. And that's kind of the strategy that's eased my mind and my planning a little bit. And so I think that's kind of what you were saying, right?
Yeah, it makes things so much less stressful. Well, never mind. It's still stressful because it's teaching.
Yeah,
make sure you're doing
always
enough.
Stressful.
But it's easier. It's just easier. You've got the focus isn't on the curriculum and what you're going to do there. The focus is on the different levels of the students and where they should be and making sure. And we talked about this. We've talked about this on several episodes. The students need to know. They need to know their expectations. They need to know where they should be. And you're mixed with their 2 and 4, where, I mean, level 2 in our district, mid-year expectation is a novice high, and end-of-year expectation is an intermediate low. And really, the difference between that isn't huge. It comes down to that mistake thing. Usually the level 2 students, and even some level 3 students, they get afraid to make those mistakes. They're just stuck in their formulas because they can do it really well. So some of those level 2s, they might need a little more hand-holding to get them to make those mistakes and force those mistakes. And in the long run, that'll help them be a little bit more creative with the language and mix and match things up. So to me, that one seems more daunting where you've got a 2 and a 4, where 4s for us are intermediate mid-range and 2s are novice high. That's what have you found that to be successful in that? I know you've got other classes in there, but with those level 2s,
It's challenging. It really is challenging. Whenever I can, I don't think that I've been able to have the exact same content in that class for both of those people. But whenever I can, just as a practical example here, I will give the level 2 kids talk about health stuff. So talking about foods that are healthy and not healthy and things like that. And I would just expect a level 2 person to be able to say at novice high, to be able to basically just start doing early intermediate things like creating their own sentences and piecing things together and having kind of some new ideas that are not these formulas. And that's all I expect out of them. But level 4, who should have a lot more vocabulary in that area, because we start talking about in level 4 things like well, I don't know, in theory, they've already gone through health and happiness from level three, mm-hmm. talking about their bodies and fitness disease and that, fitness and all that stuff. And so they can kind of then combine that with the food stuff. And that's what I would expect out of them, is to say, okay, these foods are healthy, and a level two can tell me that, and they can give me a basic why and why not, maybe level two. But a level four should be able to connect foods that are healthy and unhealthy and disease. And level four kind of reaches out into cultural differences and things like that. You know, why, what is it about German culture and what is it about American culture that means we have different views on being healthy or something like that? I don't know. So they just, I try to keep it in line, and the curriculum designers in our district have done a good job. I know you were part of that, Miles. So, done a good job of aligning that so that it kind of makes it easier at all those levels. But long story short, I guess I try as the best I can to give similar content, but with a lot deeper expectations for level four. And I would expect them to be able to start making connections, that level two can't, between the units in level two and level three.
Yeah. And just as you're talking, I was just thinking this, something I've noticed recently is my level threes and fours and my level fours, in that mix, they still kind of struggle. There's not that they don't remember stuff from years one and two. Which is another thing why world language classes are really difficult, especially at the higher levels, because you've got to remember, at college I was always worried about, is this a comprehensive course? Like at the end of the year, do you have to remember everything? With foreign languages, world languages, you have to remember not everything, but most things from level one to two to three to four and so on.
Right.
You can't, but sometimes they forget. So I found that actually those simple, easy things that we would expect a novice student to be able to do at the beginning of lessons for my level, higher levels, it helps them. It's like, oh, I didn't know I could use it in this way. I didn't even think about using it in different ways, because they get in that cardboard cutting, that cookie cutter box of, I can only do it this way. I can't see anything else. So that's something I found interesting recently, is like, I need to start simpler and then just ramp it up a little bit quicker. So we've kind of touched on and talked about some of the positives, some of what we've done that's worked. Like we got from our interviews, the grouping strategy, which is something I need to do a little bit better at and think of it in terms of the four modes of communication, the modalities, or even the modes of communication, interpretive, interpersonal, and presentational, where maybe have different groups based on those. We talked about, you know, teaching to where it's taught at the same class. The curriculum's the same for everybody. The expectations are just what changes. So for me, That's been the perfect solution so far, is treating everybody or using the same curriculum for everybody, but just making sure they're aware of and keeping myself aware of the different expectations for their levels. Just a really quick example with that, on a recent assignment that I had, it was just writing a postcard, but I had students that were level four students that didn't get a grade that they or grade or didn't get a score that they were hoping. And really the difference from a level three to four, the biggest one is starting to connect your sentences, and then also referencing different time frames at that intermediate mid level. And a lot of their scores were what I was giving them was intermediate lows. And I left notes on a lot of their assignments saying, all you need to do, and probably the biggest thing to do, and we practiced this afterwards, was use specific examples. If you're going to use specific examples, you're going to have to talk about something that happened. So you're going to try to reference different time frames. My level three students aren't going to be as good at as the level fours should be, but they're going to try to do that. And that seemed to, originally that's something that kind of flopped. The instruction didn't quite reach them, and they didn't quite push themselves to do a little bit more. I'm going to pick on Brandon here since he's here. I can't pick on Davin or, actually let's pick on Davin and Roger. What do you guys have to say? They're gone, so we can't pick on them. I'm going to pick on Brandon here. Just tell everybody how your biggest failure. No, tell everybody where you've tried something, tried a strategy that just didn't seem to work for you. Not that it can't work for somebody else, but it just blew up in your face, figuratively, we hope.
Yeah, well, this was kind of just maybe implied by our suggestion to make it one class that's on one lane of content, but your expectations and your grading are what's different. For me, trying to do it not that way at first was a big failure, and it was so frustrating to me. And stations was my best solution, but I wasn't very good at that. And my classroom's not that big. I don't know. It kind of just was really hard. So, you know, trying to say, okay, German twos over here. I got to tell you these words and these phrases and these couple of rules that you need to remember. And then let me come over here and I'll run over to level three. And you guys got to remember, this and these words over here, which are slightly different than these words over here. That just didn't work very well. And I think it really was a revelation to realize you can do this all at once. You can have all the kids in the weight room at one time and you can say, we are all working on bench pressing today and form on bench pressing. But Billy, you've got to have three plates on there. Michael, you only need one. This is your first year in the weight room. So that's where you can go and get everyone started. We're all doing the same thing. We're all talking about the same thing. But like you said, you tell your level three kids, you've got to give me more specific examples. And then I can go to my level two kids and say, I don't need quite as many specific examples from you guys yet, but you got to have these chunks memorized that are important to your proficiency level. So anyway, my biggest failure was starting out attempting to treat them like four classes in one class. And I don't think that's necessary or even the best thing to do, even in a perfect situation, because it's good to have everyone together. I've had level fours talk with level threes all the time. Even level twos talk with level fours, which is a stretch because you're going up from novice to intermediate. But anyway, I'd say that's one of my biggest failures. And then I have a lot of just individual activity failures that have been, I thought would be awesome, but just weren't as exciting.
So just to kind of to close up, we've really been talking about some of the strategies for split level classes and what has worked and maybe some things that didn't quite work well, and appreciate Brandon for being willing to share failures. And that's something that we've talked a lot about so far, and we've used that phrase to fail better next time. And I don't remember if it was Welker or Roger or who it was. I don't know why I use last names and first names, by the way. That's a weird thing. but one of you had used the quote that, don't be afraid to not do something again. Or to never do something again.
It was Roger.
It was Roger. And somebody else, it was somebody else that said it. So I don't want to say Roger said it. I mean, maybe it was him. But no, so that quote, don't be afraid to never do something again. If you have an idea and you think it's going to work, don't be afraid to try it. Give it a try. We're as fallible as anybody else. The student should understand that we make mistakes and we learn from them too. And be willing to try something and fail. And if it doesn't work, then try to do it a different way next time or throw it out the window, whatever you need to do. But if it does work, keep working at it. Maybe there's some fine tuning you can do, or if it doesn't work, see what you can change, modify about it. Check us out on our webpage at lulpodcast.com. Leave any questions or comments or even any strategies that you have that you found to be helpful and that work for you in a split level classroom. Leave us a comment under episode 6. If you have any comments or questions on prior episodes, they're open to leave comments as well. Next week, we'll have a treat. We'll have some more interviews from other teachers within the district. Brandon will be talking to us, and they'll be talking to us about project-based learning, what it is and how we can incorporate into a classroom, and you may actually already be doing it. So check that out. We'll get that posted as well, so you can have questions or comments that you may want them to address during that podcast. From us here at our studio in B1, we just want to be sure to wish you all a happy Thanksgiving. And to go along with that, I just want to say how grateful I am to work with Brandon since you're here, and Davin and Roger, who are again off at ACTFL, bringing back some fantastic information for us. They've already been messaging us a lot of things we can use. It's just really grateful to work with you and to be able to share this experience with those of you that are listening out there. And
right back at you, buddy.
Yeah, we appreciate it. It's fantastic. I don't want to say brotherhood, but that's kind of sexist. This cadre of teachers. That's my big word of the day, even though it's what, only five letters. It's a fantastic cadre to be a part of. What's another word for group? Let us know another word for group.
A murder, a gaggle.
A murder is for crows. A gaggle is for what?
Turkeys or something.
Turkeys. Yeah. Anyway, I'll be watching my favorite movie for Thanksgiving, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Although if you don't like rated R movies, don't watch it. It's got a lot of the swear in it. But it's fantastic. The best Thanksgiving movie out there.
John Candy is one of the best holiday movie actors of all time.
John Candy is fantastic. Yeah. Canadian. Like Rick Moranis, my man crush. I don't know what it is about Rick Moranis, but I just think he's fantastic. I've mentioned the webpage, but also follow us on Twitter at LUL Podcast. We've already got a few followers from Actful there. It's great. You can tweet us questions at any point, and we'll try to address those on future podcasts as we can. Thanks again one last time for Celia and Jake for joining us today. And with that, I'll say a plus.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Thanks for getting down with Level Up.
Do whatever because it's Spanish and Spanish always works.
Right. Oh, no.
Thanks, Davin.
That was Davin.
Maybe that was Rush.
I don't know who that was.